May it please the court, Ken Skog, number 17053. On behalf of the appellants, the Andersons, and with me at council table is Dana Baggs of our firm as well. Now the court now has to shift gears from a criminal matter to one dealing with real estate, and I'll just do a quick synopsis of the case just to shift our gears here. This case is based upon the creation of an equitable lien on real property and the enforcement of that lien through judicial foreclosure proceedings. The relevant facts tie back to October of 2008 when the Andersons sold their property at 1710 Sunset Boulevard in Boulder, Colorado to the Channons. And when they sold that property, they carried back $850,000 of the purchase price with a promissory note, deed of trust. The promissory note was for 1 year. And in 2009, on the 1 year anniversary, the Channons were unable to pay back that indebtedness, and the parties agreed to extend. And in extending that promissory note, they entered into an allonge and modification agreement. I'll just refer to that document as the allonge. And that allonge did a number of things. Number one, it extended the time period. It modified the interest rate. And most important for our discussion and for our purposes in this case, it also added additional collateral, and that is the 1676 Sunset Boulevard property that was also owned by the Channons. And they agreed to secure the $850,000 indebtedness with that 1676 property as well as the 1710 property. And that was all set forth in the allonge and modification agreement. The allonge made clear the party's intent that the 1676 property would serve as additional collateral for the modified note. And the allonge referenced a deed of trust on the 1676 property that the Channons were to deliver, but they did not. Accordingly, in December of 2009, the Andersons recorded the allonge in the Boulder County Real Property Records. The allonge on its face provided that the amount of the indebtedness was $850,000, an interest rate, a legal description for the property, the 1676 property. In October of 2010, the note again matured, and the Channons were unable to pay the amount, and they had sold the property in November of 2010 to the Garfinkels, and by the property I'm referring to the 1676 property. When the Channons failed and refused to make any payments to the Andersons filed suit. Two claims were asserted. First was a claim against Mrs. Shannon, Kimberly Channon, for judgment on the note. Mr. Channon had filed bankruptcy and was not a party to the action. And also a second claim for judicial foreclosure based on the lien created by the allonge on the 1676 property. The Andersons filed motion for summary judgment on both claims. The Garfinkels filed a cross motion for summary judgment on the second claim. The trial court granted summary judgment to the Andersons on the first claim and granted the Garfinkels summary judgment on the second claim. There are two very important findings by the court in its order. The allonge constituted an equitable lien on the 1676 property as it related to the Channons. That's one important finding. The second is that the equitable lien was not enforceable against the Garfinkel, and the justifications for that by the trial court were, number one, that the Garfinkels were not unjustly enriched, and number two, that the Garfinkels were bona fide purchasers without notice of the equitable lien.
Counsel, are we bound by those findings in the context of a motion for summary judgment that's being appealed?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the court is. I believe that the court's determination is de novo. I do think, however, that it is telling that the court made these findings. Those findings were not cross-appealed. I think it is telling that it was obvious to the trial court that the allonge manifested an intent by the parties to create an encumbrance on the 1676 property. The Andersons, of course, brought this appeal challenging the trial court's ruling on the equitable lien not being enforceable and foreclosable against the 1676 property, and challenging whether the Garfinkels had notice of the lien and are subject thereto.
Mr. Scott, can I just jump ahead a little bit?
Of course.
So if I understand, the dispute here is whether the allonge created an encumbrance on the property, or whether a deed of trust created an encumbrance, and whether the allonge simply created an equitable lien against the amount of money owed.
Yeah, I think that all of those things have been argued here, but it's our position certainly that the allonge created an equitable lien against the property, the allonge itself. And the requirements under Griffin, in order for that allonge to exist, are that there be a contract that manifests an intent to pledge an interest in the property in exchange for a debt.
But in the Griffin case, there was no reference to another document. The document itself, the note itself, created the lien. It misspelled the word lien, but it said lien, and then it gave the legal description. Here, the only way that there's any security interest created is by continually referencing the deed of trust. The allonge itself does not say we hereby create a lien, or that the parties intend to create a lien. It merely says that the debt indebtedness is secured by a deed of trust.
Well, Your Honor, I understand the point, but I think that distinction from Griffin is, while a distinction without a difference, because the allonge manifests on the face of the document an intent to secure the indebtedness with the 1676 property. Agreed, it's through reference to another document, but there's no question in reviewing the document, the allonge, that one would understand that it was the clear intent of the parties that there would be, in fact, an encumbrance on the 1676 property to secure that indebtedness. And I completely understand this reference to the deed of trust, and I'll talk about the notice issue and the statute in a moment, but that reference is the same as in a UCC conveyance. A security agreement is generally the document that identifies, but then there's also a financing step that is used to secure or to perfect that security interest, and that financing statement likewise reflects the intent to create a security interest. Multiple documents can, in fact, reflect the party's intent, but it does not detract from that intent, the fact that it references another document as well as the allonge itself.
Mr. Scott, what in regard to your analogy to a financing statement, the reason that I'm not sure that it follows here is because here there was no deed of trust on the 1676 property.
Well, Your Honor, the only thing a deed of trust would do is you would record it in the real property records, and it would reflect the security interest. The allonge was recorded in the real property records and reflected the existence of this security interest.
Well, the deed of trust, in effect, conveys the beneficial interest, conveys the legal title to the deed of trust to the public trustee, and therefore a beneficial interest to the creditor. In this situation, there isn't anything like that. All they say is, we've agreed we're going to do a deed of trust, and it'll cover this property, and all the terms are set forth in that deed of trust, references made to the deed of trust. But it doesn't go beyond that. All of the references to any kind of a security interest are made exclusively with respect to a deed of trust, which in fact was never executed or recorded.
Oh, that is true, Your Honor, that it was never executed or recorded. The difference I think that the court is identifying is to the remedies that would be available to foreclose on whatever lien is created. And I agree, had the deed of trust been recorded, there would have been public trustee foreclosure. Absolutely, it would be much easier. The problem is, of course, that for reasons that are not in the record and not relevant to this court's determination, the Channons did not end up delivering that deed of trust. And the Andersons clearly were not without recourse, because they had a signed agreement between the parties that was intended to encumber the 1676 property. So in fact, they recorded that allonge. And that recording of the allonge has the effect of sharing with the world the party's agreement that, in fact, 1676 property was going to be security for this indebtedness.
But now, a person reading it would say, oh, okay, so there's a deed of trust that's being recorded. I'll check the records and see if I can find the deed of trust. Not finding a deed of trust, they would therefore assume that that part of the agreement was not carried out. And under the statute, they would be permitted to therefore disregard it.
Well, I'll come back to the statute in a moment, but I disagree with the, respectfully disagree with the conclusion that they could just simply disregard the allonge.
No, the deed of trust.
Well, a deed of trust was never recorded.
Right.
Okay, and so we're in agreement there. The allonge would cause, put someone on inquiry notice, and they would have to search the real property records for the deed of trust. Not seeing one, they would just ignore the fact that the allonge was recorded at their own peril, because the allonge identifies that there's $850,000 in debt of debt out there that was intended to be secured by this property. A mere investigation, a mere call to the Andersons, or pursuit of the some investigation to satisfy their inquiry notice would have revealed that, in fact, that $850,000 indebtedness had not been satisfied.
Why don't you jump into the statute? Because that's
Let's turn our attention to that, because that truly goes to the heart of the matter, which is whether or not the Garfinkels are a VFP. If you look at the statute, and of course we're talking about 3835-108, the important part of the statute says that an instrument contains a recitation of or reference to some other instrument purporting to affect title to said real property. Such recitation or reference shall bind only the parties to the instrument and shall not be noticed to any other person whatsoever. Here, if we were before this court and before the trial court asking to enforce a deed of trust that was not recorded but was referenced in a document, this statute precludes us from arguing that there's constructive or inquiry notice of that deed of trust, because it's not in the record. It's merely recited in a document that's in the record. It does not, however, suggest that or preclude any information within the allonge itself and the equitable lien created by the allonge itself being noticed to the world. And the example that we provided in our reply brief, I think, is appropriate. If A conveys Black Acre to B by warranty deed, and in that warranty deed says that there are ditch rights that are in an agreement dated December 2007, that ditch rights agreement, if it's not recorded, cannot be enforced, is not noticed to anyone of the terms of that agreement except the parties to that agreement. But it doesn't undermine the effectiveness of that deed, and it certainly does not undermine the constructive notice to the world of the conveyance of that deed. Similarly here, the allonge is still in full force and effect, and the equitable lien that was created in the allonge is still notice. Parties are on notice because that document was recorded.
But Mr. Scott, you say in your brief that allonge in and of itself provides actual constructive and inquiry notice. Is that a correct statement?
It is, Your Honor. Certainly.
So how does it provide actual notice? Because it appears that, at least I thought from reading the briefs, that the Garfinkels did not have actual notice.
Well,
is that correct?
That you are correct, Your Honor. It provides actual notice to those who read it. It provides constructive notice to those who acquire property and that document's in the chain of title. It creates inquiry notice as it relates to having been recorded, and anyone who would have constructive notice would also have inquiry responsibilities with respect to their review of that record. With all due respect, if I may, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You may.
Thank you.
You have 1 minute and 23 seconds.
May it please the court, Gary Swingle, number 21239, representing the appellees, the Garfinkels. I'd like to start in with the point that Mr. Skog just entered his argument with, and that was a discussion of 3835-108. Essentially, the Andersons' position is that regardless of if there's a reference to another document, if there's sufficient information in the recorded instrument, that's enough despite 3835-108. If that was the case, Your Honor, essentially we'd be nullifying 3835-108. There aren't going to be very many cases where there's not information in the document that references the instrument that actually affects the property. Now, the court has considered this factual question in a couple of other cases, in Gilpin and in Rocky Mountain Fuel Company. Both of those cases would have been decided differently if Mr. Skog was correct about the law. And I think it's worth noting that in their reply brief, they simply ignore both of those cases because there's no way to distinguish them. There's plenty of information in both of those recorded documents. But both the Supreme Court and this court in those two cases said, we can't look at that because 3835.108 prevents us from doing so. Now, regarding the hypothetical that Mr. Skog uses about the deed, well, the distinction between that and our case is that in his hypothetical, the deed is the actual instrument affecting title to the real property. That's not the case here. It would be the case if the allonge was a legal lien.
Are you saying that the allonge does not affect an interest in real property?
I'm saying the allonge does not affect an interest in real property because the allonge has been held by the trial court not to be a legal lien.
If that's the case, then does Section 3835.108 even apply? Because that only applies when a deed or any other instrument in writing affects title to real property.
Well, I should have been more clear on that. I'm saying there is an aspect of the allonge that affects the real property. Specifically, if you look at paragraph 8, there's a subordination provision, which essentially says that the deed of trust referenced in the allonge is going to be subordinate to the construction loan that the Chans were taking out. So that does affect the title to real property, and that is why 3835.108 does apply. But in the broader sense, is the allonge directly a lien on the 1676 property? The answer to that is no. And again, the trial court ruled on that below, and I'll get to that in a moment.
It does, however, reflect an intent by the parties to create some type of a lien, doesn't it?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and we've never denied that. What it represents, and I think Mr. Skog and the Andersons admit, is it represented an intent that a deed of trust on the 1676 property was going to be recorded, and that was going to be the lien. Now, what happened, if you look at the date of the allonge, it's dated October 14th, 2009. It was not recorded until October 24th, 2009.
On the December?
Excuse me, December 24th, 2009. There's over a two-month gap. In that two-month gap, the record reflects that the Shannons refused to execute the deed of trust encumbering the 1676 property. Now, what Mr. Skog said in his oral argument was, and I'm quoting, the Andersons were not without recourse. They had a signed contract, the allonge. And he's absolutely right. They had a legal remedy. They could have refused to go forward with the loan modification, and they could have sued the Shannons for breach of the allonge, for breach of contract. But they chose not to do that. What they did was they chose to record the allonge knowing that the deed of trust it referenced didn't exist. I think that in itself is enough to preclude equitable relief, because they certainly weren't acting equitably when they did that. They were filing a document that they knew, in essence, contained false information. Now, it's important that Mr. Skog has admitted that they had, you know, that they were not without recourse, that they had a legal remedy, because we cite a case in Remarriage of Hall, which held specifically that when a legal remedy exists, the general rule regarding equitable remedies applies, that being we don't go to an equitable remedy if there is a legal remedy. In the Hall case, which is remarkably similar to Layton on its facts, they were both dissolution of marriage cases, and in both essentially permanent orders or the dissolution orders said that the one of the spouses was going to get paid out of the home. In Layton, an equitable lien was enforced. In Hall, it wasn't, even though the husband in Hall relied on Layton and said, well, if there's an equitable lien in Layton, there's one here too. The Court of Appeals said, nope, that's not the case here because there is a legal remedy.
And the legal remedy would be what, they would sue for specific performance?
No. The legal remedy in Hall was that...
No, in this case.
Oh, in this case, they could have sued for damages. They could have sued for specific performance. They could have simply not gone forward with the loan modification. and demanded immediate payment of the note.
I mean, it's obvious here that there's not enough money to pay anybody, and a specific performance would be seeking the equitable power of the court. So that's why we
haven't cited specific performance in our briefs. What we've said is they could sue for breach of contract, and they could get an immediate judgment on the note. What they've done is they've simply tried to, pass the buck onto an innocent third-party purchaser.
Is in establishing a legal remedy, isn't it necessary to establish that funds could be recovered on a judgment? I mean, that's the whole idea of getting collateral, is that in case there's not enough funds to pay for it, that you have the collateral to turn to.
Well, I don't think that, first of all, if they had sued right away on a legal remedy, at that point in time, the Shannons would have still owned the property. So they would have been able to get at least the equity out of the property, which I think the Shannons got, I can't remember the amount now, I think it's around $400,000 they got when that property sold. So they would have at least been able to recover that. So there was money there at the time, but they chose, for reasons I don't know, they're not in the record, to go forward rather than seeking immediate legal relief against the Shannons. Now, they recognize that the availability of a legal remedy is a problem for them. So even though they didn't appeal the trial court's ruling that there is no legal lien, and they didn't argue that they had a legal lien or anything approaching a legal lien in their opening brief on appeal, in their reply they sort of do argue that they have a legal lien. They essentially try to say that an equitable lien, which is based on an agreement, is sort of a quasi-legal lien. It's different than an equitable lien based on a relationship. Now, they're not able to cite any authority to support that, and I'm not aware of any. To my mind, certainly an equitable lien is an equitable lien, and regardless of whether you base it on a relationship or an agreement, a court has to look at the facts involved and determine the equities and see whether an equitable lien should be declared, whether it's based on a relationship or whether its origin is an agreement. But they rely on one case to try to make this argument, and that's Baracus versus Bohemia Import Company. Now, in that case, it involved a salesman who was trying to recover commissions from accounts receivable of the company that he sold products for. And the court in that case examined both whether there was an agreement on which an equitable lien could be based, and whether there was a relationship or other equities on which an equitable lien could be based. And they ended up holding that, no, there was neither one, and there was no equitable lien. After analyzing both branches of the test for equitable lien, the Court of Appeals stated, where plaintiff had a plain and adequate remedy at law, equity will not intervene, close quote. Now, the Andersons cite that case for the proposition that you're denied an equitable lien based on a relationship if there's a legal remedy, but you're not denied a equitable lien based on an agreement, even though there's a legal remedy. Well, read Baracus, please. There's nothing in the case that supports that. The court did not make any distinction between the two branches of equitable liens. It simply made the broad statement that if there's a legal remedy, we're not going to give equitable relief. It didn't say we're going to give it as to one and not as to the other. And I certainly haven't been able to find any case that said that. Again, I think it's worth noting that although Anderson spent a large portion of their reply brief talking about issues related to this legal lien issue or whether the agreement is a quasi-legal lien, that they don't even bother to discuss in Remarriage of Hall, which is the whole case they're trying to avoid. And the reason for that is very simple. There's no way to avoid Hall. The other thing they do argue, however, they say that the Garfinkels are precluded from arguing the availability of a legal remedy on appeal because it's not supported by the record below. That's simply not the case. If you look at the record below, which is a record on summary judgment, look at the sites in our cross motion for summary judgment response at pages 3-6, which is the record site for you, 176 to 179, where we talk about the Andersons going forward with the loan modification, even though the Andersons had refused to execute the deed of trust. And if you look at page 14 of the cross motion, which is record 187, there we actually argue that they should be denied equitable relief because their own conduct has led to this problem. That conduct being they went forward with the loan modification as opposed to seeking some kind of legal remedy against the Channons. The Andersons cite two cases to try to say that we can't make this argument on appeal, and I think if you look at those two cases, you'll see they both show that we can. The Rohrer case is a Colorado Supreme Court case, and in that case, the Supreme Court allowed a legal argument to be made for the first time on appeal. In fact, it noted the first time it was made was in the answer brief to the Court of Appeals, yet it still considered it because it was supported by the record below. Now, the other case that the Anderson site is the Greenfield case, which is a Court of Appeals case. Now, in that case, the Court of Appeals ruled that there wasn't sufficient record supports for the argument to allow it to be made on appeal. But I think the key part of that case is that in Greenfield, the defendants had opposed discovery as to the very issue that they were trying to use to get an affirmance on appeal. That's why there was no record, because the defendants had opposed discovery. We have nothing like that here. All the facts relating to whether or not they had a legal remedy available to them are really within their control. There was no discovery that we denied them. So I don't think there's any question we can bring the argument, and I think it's dispositive.
Mr. Swingle, excuse me for interrupting. I wanted to ask you about your discussion about a legal remedy, and you're saying a while ago that you thought there were $400,000 in proceeds from the sale of the property to the Garfinkels. But the briefs also said that if there had been a deed of trust, the Channon's position would have been in either fourth position or some subordinate position. So does the record reflect whether the Channon's would have been able to receive that $400,000 or some lesser amount?
I have to make a logical deduction to get you there, Your Honor. And my deduction is that if there were sufficient liens on the property at the time of the sale to the Garfunkels, the Channons would not have gotten $400,000 at that time. So I can't tell you from the record, but just based on the sale of the Garfunkels, it would appear that $400,000 would have been available to the Andersons as well if they had brought a legal claim timely instead of going forward with loan modification.
So in under the case law, does a legal remedy have to be an adequate legal remedy, or is a partial legal remedy sufficient?
Your Honor, I admit that I'm not certain of the answer to that question. I don't want to come here and kid you. I haven't looked at it.
Because if you're correct that they could have gotten $400,000, mm-hmm. that wouldn't have satisfied the amount that they were owed.
It wouldn't have, but certainly, you know, in their reply brief, once we, you know, when this argument was raised, the Andersons didn't argue that they would have only had a partial legal remedy, and so my suspicion is that even a partial legal remedy would be enough to deny that equitable relief. But even beyond that, I mean, before we even get to the availability of a legal remedy, obviously our position is that there's no equitable lien at all because the allonge was never intended to be a lien. And that's evidenced so clearly by the subordination provision, another argument that's ignored on appeal and was ignored below. And obviously the construction lender required the subordination provision. If the allonge was a lien, it would have been subordinated as well as the deed of trust. I think my time is up in 3 seconds. So.
Thank you, counsel. And thank both counsel. Oh, excuse me, Mr. Skog. I didn't mean to cut you off. You have another minute and 23 seconds.
Thank you. I realize my time is short. May it please the court, with all due respect to counsel, I think he took my comments about not being without recourse out of context. What I was talking about was in terms of the remedies available under the allonge as opposed to not having the deed of trust in place. The other issue that counsel makes argument about legal remedy, well, Justice Taubman, the fact of the matter is I think the law is pretty clear that it says an adequate remedy at law. And we certainly contend, although again this was not raised adequately below, that in fact there was no adequate remedy at law. The part of the problem here too is that there are two different ways in which an equitable lien is created. One is by a written agreement reflecting an intent to secure property with an indebtedness. That's the Griffin case. The Leiden case also acknowledges that there's a second way, and it's an or, it's not an and. You don't have to satisfy both. But the second is under circumstances of a relationship where the court employs its equitable powers to determine that, in fact, an equitable lien should exist. And counsel and the trial court ignored the distinction between those two ways of creating an equitable lien. And we believe that the allonge creates an equitable lien just the same as in the Griffin case. I understand that we do have an added complexity with respect to the reference to the deed of trust, but again, I submit that that's a distinction without a difference because, in fact, the allonge does reflect an intent to secure the property with an indebtedness.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
And thank you both, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted, and a decision will be forthcoming in due course. This